Hey everybody out there in internet land, it's Robert Pandia with Give a Shift. I'm back after a pretty significant break over this summer, so I apologize if you missed the sound of my monotone voice droning on about motorcycles, but I hope you enjoyed whatever you're doing this summer, and you know, I thought I would take an opportunity. I'm out here on the West Coast right now. I kind of threw together a quick trip for sort of work reasons and personal reasons and whatever. And as it turned out, I had a chance to ride for the first time, a significant ride, with my friend Charles Fleming of the LA Times. Hello, Charles.
Hey, Robert. How are you?
I'm groovy, thanks. So we've had a fun day. Where did we meet? What's the name of that little town?
We met in the town of Wrightwood. The mountain town of Wrightwood on the Angeles Crest Highway.
And I stayed at the fanciest Best Western Plus at Cajon Pass, right? You know, so $96 in a comfy room later, and it was a chance to catch up with Charles and go for a ride. And we've been threatening to ride together for a little while, so it's kind of great to do that. And Charles and I are both kind of into adventure bikes more than the street bike ride that we're doing today, but I was limited in the FZ09 that I have with me, so thanks for riding down to my level.
It was a stretch.
Thanks. So anyway, I want to thank Charles for doing a little gas podcast here, and you're not working directly for the LA Times anymore, right? You've kind of a quasi-semi-retirement-ish.
I've moved to more of a freelance contract position with them rather than a full-time position, in part so that I can do more of this, in part so that I have more free time to ride motorcycles and concentrate on friendships like the friendship that I have with you.
Oh, that's cool. And you just had a big trip out to Japan, and you're talking a little bit about bike riding out there and how it's so different than it is out here. You want to tell us a little bit about that trip, maybe some highlights of that?
Indeed. I joined MotoQuest for their 2018 Hokkaido ride. They've been doing this ride for a few years and have got it dialed in brilliantly. The ride is led by MotoQuest founder and co-leader Phil Freeman, who actually lived in Hokkaido, Japan for a few years when he was a young man and has been there for several rides. So he's got a terrific route designed. It's a 9-day ride through the backcountry, which is all they have, by the way, in Hokkaido. And what makes it really particularly special and different is not only is Hokkaido sort of the Japan's Alaska, which means high peaks, beautiful glaciers, lovely mountains and lakes and so on, but it also means it's largely unpopulated. And it's become especially unpopulated as the economy of Japan has declined and as the population of Japan has aged. More and more young people have left Hokkaido and moved to either to the big city or they've moved down to Tokyo and the main island of Honshu. So the result is you have these marvelous roads and you have nobody on them.
Wow.
Which means you can really go very unique for Japan, as you can imagine. You can ride 2, 3, and 4 hours at a time on these marvelous, twisty, windy country roads in the mountains and not see anybody at all, which makes it a very special kind of riding.
So is the riding out there, I mean, I've never actually been to Japan, but would you count it as aggressive or respectful or... I mean, I know it depends a little bit on the
individuals.
Well,
you're talking about
the way
we rode or the way the locals rode.
It's interesting to me. I've been to India, for instance. I wasn't on a motorcycle, but I've been to India, and I understand how there's so many people riding around on two wheels, and through Western eyes, you see that, and you're like, God, nobody's wearing a helmet, and everyone's going to die, and whatever. And then you realize that, you know, the fastest you're going to end up going is like 25 miles an hour. Everybody in a car knows that there is a motorcycle next to them. They make that assumption right off the bat. So once you're in the reality of it versus just a photograph of it, it feels like really different. So what was...
Well, the Japanese are, you know, known internationally, well-deservedly so, for their civility and their good manners, and it extends to their driving. They drive in the same very civil, almost formal way that they comport themselves on the street and everywhere else. So you are not at risk in Japan of being knocked over by a Yahoo remotely. That's just not going to happen. Sometimes there were moments when we were out in the middle of nowhere where we suffered from the fact that there was nobody on the road, because the other drivers assumed also that there was nobody on the road. So a farm vehicle will simply pull out onto the highway almost without looking, because what is the chance that there's going to be anybody there? Oh, very little chance. So there was a little bit of that, but the speed limits are very low. The police presence is very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Most places in Japan, there are speed cameras everywhere in Japan, except not so much in Hokkaido.
Oh, really?
So we were able to use these mountain roads at perhaps a speed limit that was a little bit more than the one that the people that designed those roads desired, without actually running afoul of the law.
But within an envelope of ridership, I would assume that the riders who go on a trip like this aren't you know, 6 months into having their motorcycle license.
Usually. No, and I think MotoQuest is very cagey about whom they invite on these trips and how they gently suggest to people that maybe this isn't the right trip for you at this time, if it's something that they feel is going to be above the skill level or the pleasure level of a newer rider, or perhaps a much older rider, or a rider who's out of shape or whatever. Because they do so many different kinds of trips, they've probably honed this better than the rest of us. So they know that the rider who's just right for their Peru trip might not be just right for their Hokkaido trip, might not be just right for their Alaska trip or their Grand Canyon trip. So they managed to select for the ride that I was on a group of people who were all very well suited to the ride and very well suited to riding with each other.
Oh, cool.
It was a very agreeable group to be on.
Oh, that's great. Well, welcome back home. And welcome back to rude Americans who don't pull over, and to people who come whipping out of intersections without thinking about it. My last frustration was at the gas pump when people just leave their car in front of the gas pump. God, it drives me nuts. So anyway,
they got to go get their big gulps. They got to go get their Slurpees in there.
Holy cow! Diabetics of line three, please. Right. So anyway, in riding here, I mean, back to reality in the States and sort of some of the shifts and changes that have been happening in the motorcycle industry, your perspective, not working directly for the LA Times anymore, has kind of maybe opened things up a little bit for you, as far as you can kind of pick your own assignments to some degree, is that
right? To some degree, yeah.
Yeah, and what are you interested in reporting now? What's coming up that's like sort of percolating for you?
Well, you know as well as I do that everybody is on the bubble.
Yeah.
There's the sense that this is a critical time or approaching a critical time in the industry, that change is not only necessary but mandatory, and that the next few years are going to see, for a variety of reasons, probably a lot more shakeout than has been seen probably since the 2008 collapse.
Talk about shakeout. Are you talking about like OEMs going away, or are you talking about dealers shutting down, or how do you see
all
that?
Of the above.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all heard the nightmare stories of zero growth. We've heard the nightmare stories of the dealerships that are only in business anymore because they're hanging onto the real estate for long enough to sell it at a profit, that they're just babysitting the real estate with their dealerships, that they're not selling enough in the way of motorcycles, parts, and apparel and service to make a living anymore. So I think there will be consolidation. There will be OEMs that scale back. There are OEMs that rise.
Mm-hmm.
OEMs that rise to meet the challenges of a changing motorcycle population, an aging motorcycle population, an electrifying population,
mm-hmm.
a global population.
Yeah.
I think you're starting to see companies think a little bit more intelligently, as the car companies have had to do in this country, more intelligently about the world market, and start to maybe make motorcycles that may not be appropriate for their main market, but make an awful lot of sense for a subsidiary market that could turn into the main market, whether that's Brazil or India or China.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think we're at a period of great change.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about the tariff thing because I think that's been beaten to death. But I think you're right about the sort of the globalization of the market, because in working with product managers in my role, they have to create something that's going to sell and make money for the company, right? And so there's always the famous lament about, oh, Europe gets all the good stuff, right? But meanwhile, there's a product manager here in the States who might be an enthusiast, but still has to balance that up against the level of business. So conversely, you know, I could see brands that begin to make motorcycles that are more global in a certain sense, that they're going to have more success. It's really interesting to me is like, you know, what could BSA do, for instance, right? I mean, so they have an opportunity similar to what Indian had, where there was a period where nothing was being made, right? So where Harley is both emboldened but burdened by their like line of history that was continuous. That's stability, and that's all good. But on the backside of that is like it's been so evolutionary for them to make any sort of revolutionary thing is a real challenge. Whereas Indian, by the time Polaris got it, they'd been kind of dark for a while. You know, it's like nothing going on. So there was this leap of time that you had to imagine what was happening. I imagine that BSA coming in and
Norton is in a similar position. Perhaps Royal Enfield.
I think Royal
was in a similar position.
Really,
although they didn't ever stop making motorcycles, they certainly went off the map here.
Yeah,
in this country,
right,
and were allowed to come back onto the map.
Well, they're coming back
whenever way they like.
And they're coming back in an interesting way. Rod Copes who's running Royal, was with Harley, so it's not like he probably doesn't have access to the kind of resources that he did with Harley, but he certainly understands the processes that Harley would go through and. You know, in development and that kind of thing. So
few of the bikes have been delivered here that it's hard to know whether the promise is going to pay off. But I've rarely seen such surprising enthusiasm for a new motorcycle from an unexpected source as for the Royal Enfield's Himalayan.
Yeah, that's
there
is
so much enthusiasm for that, and I know so many people who have put down deposits and who cannot wait to get their bikes.
I'm seeing a lot of folks who are not ever talking about trading anything in. They're just like, I'm just adding that.
Yeah, well, it's a $5,000 motorcycle,
like,
so
well,
a lot of people think,
yeah,
well, hell, I just stick that in the corner.
Right, and then, you know, I think the Royal Enfield brand's always been interesting because that kind of bike also, which relates to millennials who are taking old bikes and creating cafe bikes and scramblers and kind of hacking them up and doing what they want, there is, in that sort of retro raw style, there is not this like performance thing where you have to go race somebody off the, you know, when the light.
Well, indeed,
green.
You can't.
Yeah,
you can't
if
it's a Royal Enfield.
Right.
You're not going to race anybody anywhere.
Right. So maybe a Prius with a low battery, but the you've got. I think that sort of thing. It's interesting that as motorcycling, in my opinion, has got to get to where it's more approachable. And it's not this, like, performance thing. The bikes we're riding today, you're on your GS, I'm on a FZ09, both fast, capable, heavy, you know, relatively heavy bikes, that sort of thing. And it's not the sort of thing that most people are going to start out on. So what are you seeing out of the industry?
Well, this is an example of where I think the globalization aspect is going to be helpful, that as companies look, for example, at the prospect of selling bikes in India and Japan and, I'm sorry, India and China, for example, or Brazil. They're looking at a market that doesn't want, can't afford, and legally might not be able to operate a 750cc motorcycle. And in any case, they would be riding that motorcycle in an environment where a 750cc bike would be inappropriate. So what do they do instead? They start developing more 100cc, 150cc, 250cc bikes, and they start developing more electric bikes, because if you want to sell bikes in China, you may well have to be selling only electric bikes, because there are more and more communities there, cities, entire regions that are outlawing anything that, you know, has two wheels and is burning gasoline.
Right. I don't imagine China as a culture where let's go on a Sunday drive for no apparent reason. There's a lot of just commuting and using it as a utility.
Right. So you have these markets that require new, interesting, innovative product for transportation, and there could be a migration of some of that product back to this country. I mean, you look at, for example, Honda's CRF 250L. That's an example of a kind of interesting, capable starter bike with, by the way, much too high a seat height, but also we'll just leave that alone for the time being. But that's an example of a product that comes out of that 250cc world that could be appropriate for all kinds of people that might not have found anything in the Honda line that matched that or in any other line.
Yeah, we need a Grom 250, don't we?
We need a bigger Grom, and we need a 450X plated, which they're bringing us also.
Yeah, that one's coming.
I'm really stoked about that.
That's cool. So, I mean, you know, the Japanese OEMs, I think, are a little bit slow sometimes in some ways, but I think they also don't get credit. Suzuki is a brand that to me has kind of lost its way a little bit. They were so hung up about racing and about that sort of thing, but when you look at the Suzuki lineup, they have got like five or six bikes that are under $5,000, I think it is. Like V-Strom 250s and the Van Van and the 250 air-cooled bike. I forget which one that's called. And that my first bike was a Suzuki 250 air-cooled bike. I joked that it had anti-lock brakes because it had drum brakes on both ends. So
you
no
couldn't
way,
lock
no
them up you if lock. Your life depended upon it, which
but,
it did.
Yeah, so anyway, the so Suzuki is, you know, to me is a brand that has an opportunity to be the most fun brand in motorcycling, you know, and just like really just like wear it, just wear the fun, just be fun, right? Van should be the hero of the lineup, in my humble opinion. But the what are you seeing out of the Japanese brands and market growth strategies, you know?
Well, you know, for example, Yamaha has picked up on the fact that they've got this great flat track legacy,
right?
And this great historic legacy that they seem to be building on. They seem to be bringing product to market that captures that with some of the badging, some of the livery, some of the style and design. So I think they've been snappier than the other Japanese brands in coming back. You look at some of the new Kawasaki product also, very much capitalizing on their heritage, bringing back bikes that look like 1970s bikes, which is smart because even though none of the guys in the marketing department got their first bikes in the 70s, there are a lot of people who did or who were 8 years old when some of those Z bikes came out and who that was the Farrah Fawcett poster on their wall was one of those Kawasaki bikes. And now that they're older, they can buy a modern bike that looks like that and feels like that. I think that's really smart product.
And on the modern side of things, I'm watching Husqvarna with a lot of interest, right? Because they're coming from a place, again, relative white sheet when it comes to street legal motorcycles as far as the modern perspective goes, right? But they're the 401 and the
Vip peeling and the smart peeling. I mean, those are fantastic looking.
They're really cool.
Ridiculous
yeah.
looking, absurd looking, surprising looking motorcycles to put into the market. There's terrible excitement about those.
I personally love a bike that kind of offends some people when they look at it. So my favorite Victory was the Vision, just because there were people who like hated it and people who loved it. Very little gray zone in the middle, and then, like, the most boring bike to me is like you know, just like black and chrome and a bagger, and it's like kind of the same thing, which is exactly what I own a an Indian Springfield that's black and chrome and it's a bagger, and it's like it's really good at what it does, but it's not the most interesting thing to look at in the world of all the new styling and all that sort of stuff out there. So it's interesting to see, you know, the growth and the changes in the brand. Indian's been making all kinds of noise about their future flat track stuff. That's an open secret, I guess, is what they would call that. That there's going to be a 1200 production one of those coming. So that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, and soon. I mean,
yeah,
within a year, I believe.
But I think that modern sense and the electric bikes, I think that's really critical, you know. And I think one kind of gripe I have in our industry is the lack of acceptance for the new stuff, you know, in some way, is that like range anxiety is this constant whiny thing. But for it's not everybody out there, but for people who are lucky enough to get to own multiple motorcycles, adding an electric motorcycle, and I put my money where my mouth is. I have a Zero FX at home. Adding an electric motorcycle to your fleet, you'll find that you might not put the most miles on that bike, but you'll start it the most, you know? I mean, you'll get on it and use it to run errands and all that sort of stuff. And what are you seeing in the electric front? Because you brought that up earlier.
I'm seeing the same ignorance, hostility, resistance that I continue to see in the electric car market. But maybe even more dyed in the wool, more entrenched, that the average motorcycle rider, when you begin to talk to that person about an electric bike, when you begin to talk about, they ask me, so what are you riding this week? What do you got in the garage? And I'll tell them, well, like, I had a long loan of a one of the new Zeros, the DS and DSR, and they volunteer the reasons why they're no good.
Yeah.
They volunteer the reasons why they can't ride one or won't ride one. And we've
talked
about
this. Even though they haven't ridden one, right?
They'll tell you that I'm just an old school, you know, I like the clutch and the gears, I like the smell of the oil and the sound, I mean, it's a visceral thing for me. Sometimes they'll say that. Sometimes they'll talk about range anxiety. They say, how far does that thing go? And you tell them, and they go, I always ride more than that. Turns out, if you talk to them, they actually don't ride more than that very often. It's like the car people that say, yeah, but what if I wanted to drive to Vegas, like on a whim? And you say, well, has that ever happened?
Yeah.
In your life? Has
yeah.
that ever happened? No.
That's like the people who live in New York, and like, I live in New York, so I can get Chinese food at 4 in the morning. It's like, when's the last time you ordered Chinese food?
Yeah,
I've never done that.
It's a fine idea, right. But it doesn't actually have any practical application. Or they'll ask you about how long does it take to recharge, and they'll say, no, because what if I get stuck somewhere? Like, why would you ever be at zero? You wouldn't be at zero anyway, so that
right.
doesn't matter. And then lately, the other objection that I hear a lot is they're dangerous. Because people can't hear you coming. The loud pipe saves lives
right.
idea applied in reverse to electric motorcycles. As if anyone going down the road in their big overstuffed SUV with the music playing, talking on their phone and updating their Facebook feed, like they're not listening to you. They can't
right.
hear you anyway. It doesn't matter what you're riding.
I think there might be a market for like professional level playing cards in the spokes of the wheels.
Yeah, maybe. Big one. Real big
really
titanium
big one
titanium carbon
like
fiber
and
carbon fiber stuff. Playing cards.
Yeah, yeah, I think there's that's $1 million idea.
But
right
the fact is, just as you say, it's easy to convert someone at least
yeah.
to the experience and the idea of electric motorcycles. And what you do is you say, just get on it. Just shut up.
Shut up and get on.
Shut up,
it.
Put on the right. helmet, put on the gloves, just go to the end of the block and come back. And they always come back, they take the helmet off, and they go, oh, my God, I had no idea.
Right.
So cool.
It's literally like a flying carpet. You know, I mean, you just and the thing is that you find that I can actually ride that bike in town quicker, not in an aggressive stand, but I have more confidence about it, because the only functionality I have is throttle application, steering and balance, and then brake application. The fact that you remove shifting out of the whole thing is like, that's multifunctional, right? Because you're blipping the throttle to match stuff, and you're shifting, and you're using the clutch, and all that sort of thing. So it's just like when you're road racing or doing track days, if you can eliminate shifts by letting a bike over rev a little bit or lug out of a corner a little bit, but then that gives you, you know, a better drive ultimately because you're not pausing to shift, you actually can end up doing a faster lap on it.
And maybe there's some bogus science in if you don't ask your left hand.
Yeah.
And your left foot
yeah.
to do very much. It
right.
liberates the right side of your brain to be more creative while
oh,
you're riding.
Deep stuff there, Charles. Always.
But what we do know is there doesn't need to be any bogus science behind this. We know for sure that if you eliminate noise, if
yeah.
you eliminate vibration,
right.
if you eliminate heat, your other senses that are not being overwhelmed by those things either are sharper or feel sharper.
Yes.
I always feel like I see better. Which I can't. I always feel like I hear better, which I can. I feel like I can smell things more intently.
Kind of become a little bit of a Superman, right? Ooh. We got food coming in.
Incoming.
We got food coming in, people. Our radio audience out there. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
God, it looks fantastic.
Anything else I can bring for you,
Fred?
Lemonade. Iced tea.
Oh, it's out of lemonade.
Just water.
Major crisis.
Thank you. Coffee?
Yeah, sure, thanks. So anyway, now we got food. We'll take a break in a little bit so we can eat. But the thing that I see in electric is if there are not significantly more aggressive demo programs, it's never going to win. You know, and like if you're interested in a Tesla, getting a demo ride in a Tesla through one of their retail centers is freaking easy, right? And they address all that stuff. But and we were talking earlier is that. Like car guys, horsepower guys, that sort of thing. They only started paying attention to Tesla when they started doing all this ludicrous mode and all that sort of thing. And that, like, you go like, wow, I want to experience that. So I'm going to figure out how to adapt my life into
yeah.
a Tesla, maybe as an additional car to the, you know, to the one I have. Or when you realize that it's so easy to rent a car for the long trip to Vegas that you just do that, you know.
Well, but you know, the car companies selling electric vehicles, they tried. Fiat tried, the Chevy Bolt EV tried. They all came with programs that said, look, we'll give you 10 free days of a rental car.
Right.
So, okay, so you want to drive to San Francisco on a whim and you're worried about plugging in? No problem. Here, take a car. It's free. And even that, I think, was not a tremendous persuader for people who hadn't
it's
had...
It's a cynical
audience.
There's a lot of cynicism
and there's a lot of ignorance. I had a friend talk to me from San Francisco about needing a new car and wanting to know what to do. And I said, you know, you should think about electric. You're ideally suited mm-hmm. for the kind of driving you do, the kind of place that you live, where your house is. You're ideally suited to getting a car like that. And he said, no, you don't understand. I live in San Francisco. I couldn't have an electric car. And I said, why? And he said, because all the hills, I need something with torque. And I said, well, that's all they have, man. Like, it's all torque.
Yeah.
Just, have you been in one? And he said, no, but I've read about them. I said, well, just go to your, there's a Fiat dealer around the corner from you. Go talk to them. Well, of course, he's a Fiat 500E owner now.
Right.
Happy as a clam.
No commission for
Found
Charles.
Out that he could get a time of use program from his utility. So now he plugs his car in at night. He runs his washing machine at night. He runs his dryer at night. He runs his dishwasher at night. And his electric bill has gone down. And he couldn't be happier about never having to go to a gas station again for the rest of his life. So that's an uphill battle in all kinds of ways. There's just so much entrenched ideology about why electric is good, why it's bad, what it stands for, what it means. And I think it's even more a more uphill battle in the two-wheel world than in the four-wheel.
We're going to take a little break and eat our quesadillas. And so I'm going to pre-apologize if you catch us burping on the back end of that. And we're going to talk about entrenched ideas and how we're going to get past that in our next segment with Mr. Charles Fleming here on the Give a Shift podcast. Thanks for listening.